Hi everyone, it's Aliza Licht here, your host, and I'm so thrilled to share that my new book, On Brand, Shape Your Narrative, Share Your Vision, Shift Their Perception, is out now. I hope you'll pick up a copy because personal branding is for everyone. It's for the new graduate starting out, the middle manager looking to level up, the executive who wants to be a thought leader, the entrepreneur starting from scratch. It's for anyone who wants to pivot or transition into something new. Because having a strong personal brand means that your name gets dropped in rooms you're not in, and that you're thought of for opportunities that other people haven't even heard of yet. So pick up a copy, and I can't wait to hear what you think. Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it. I am really excited and honored to welcome Nora Raj Brown, who is the Executive Vice President of Brand at Goop. Nora, welcome to Leave Your Mark. Your career is incredible, and I am so excited to dive into it today.
I am so excited to be here. I mean, I was gushing a little bit how I'm such a big fan of yours, so it's so nice.
Oh, stop. Well, I'm a huge fan of yours. For everyone listening, Nora oversees brand and integrated marketing, corporate positioning, talent outreach, television production, social media, influencer marketing, and press strategy for the Goop brand, and basically every initiative. And you're also the chief spokesperson of the company. But prior to that, you had an entire other career in various creative industries, most recently at Time Inc., where you led communications for the fashion and style brands, including InStyle, People, Style Watch, ExoJane, Wallpaper. And previous to that, you've had stints in talent PR. And you're also a founding board member of the political engagement organization, I Am a Voter and Commit to Change. And you know, Madonna was also a guest on Leave Your Mark. So I love that I'm having my second I Am a Voter person on the show. It's super important. What struck me most about your background, or what I can relate to most, is the idea of being a creative in a household that didn't necessarily understand creative industries. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, I grew up in Palo Alto. My parents are Indian immigrants. They came over in 1975. My dad went to grad school at Berkeley. It was an incredible, beautiful upbringing, but it was a very traditional immigrant story in that I was very much surrounded by these two industries. At that time, it was really tech and Stanford. And so my mom worked at Stanford and my dad worked in tech. And, you know, I think they had grown up without having a lot of choice in terms of the different industries that they were going to go into. You know, there's like that stereotype that people always say, mm-hmm. like, doctor, lawyer, whatever. And I think for them, and understandably, you know, they come here with pretty much nothing. They come as students. You know, when they first moved here, my mom lived in LA and my dad lived at school and they commuted. And it wasn't exactly like this easy, everything is set for you sort of environment. So I understand where they came from and that they were like, please just go to a great school and please like go be a doctor. I mean, my mom still asks me, she's like, do you think it's too late for Stanford Med School? I think it's a little too late. So they were very encouraging of that. And it's not that they weren't encouraging of the arts and things like that, but I think they were just really worried. You know, they're worried that like, we wouldn't be able to find like secure footing. And, you know, now that I'm a mother, I get it, right? You just want the best for your kids. But I decided to completely rebel against all of that.
Naturally.
Of course. So when I went to college, I studied writing literature and then Italian literature. I just was like, let me just make this as impractical as possible. And I loved school. It was so fun and inspiring. But, you know, everything they said was sort of true. Like I got out of school and I was like, okay, what am I going to do next? Like, can I go work for Vanity Fair or The New Yorker or what, you know? And I was like, oh, wait, every single person in New York wants this exact job. And there's two of them.
That's interesting. So you did have the publishing bug mm-hmm. while you were in college. So you had that sort of on the horizon.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I even had it in high school. I was the editor-in-chief of like our student magazine. And, you know, I just loved... And still now, like, I love the storytelling aspect of it. I loved writing. I loved, like, the act of it. You know, I think obviously magazines have changed so much since when we were in that industry, but you know, growing up too, it was like that was like the ultimate tastemaker. You know, I used to like read those masterminds and idolize the people who are on them.
I can really relate. And it's so funny because most people do not look at a masthead. And when you are really interested and passionate about that industry, you pore over those mastheads trying to figure out who does what, how you can fit into it. So you moved to New York.
Yeah.
What was your first job?
My first job was Details, which is now a defunct, sadly, magazine. But it was a very, people used to joke that it was like for the metrosexual. Do you remember that term?
Yes.
It was a style magazine, but it was a little more niche than GQ. It was a very like cool, interesting take. It had great writers, really awesome fashion. I mean, it was so fun. I worked in the fashion closet and just literally was in the closet for like hours on end, but I loved it. I loved every second of it.
So I can relate. I spent a lot of time in the fashion closet as well. And it's true. It's like, you're literally just packing and unpacking things. And you're like, I have the best job in the entire world.
Totally.
So competitive industry, but you did break into that. How did you early on sort of forge those connections that were going to open that door?
Well, I mean, I honestly didn't know a single person in that industry when I moved to New York. Like, again, my parents were really in, like, they were like, we can help you if you want to go work at McKinsey, but if you want to work at Vogue, like, you're on your own. So
fair.
It sounds so old fashioned, but like, I emailed people constantly and would send writing samples and would, you know, and I took an internship. I worked for free. Like I did all the things that I feel like you kind of have to do at that time to get your foot in the door. Going to every interview and trying to meet every person. And I ended up getting my second job, which was at BWR, which was a talent agency, just through like a friend's sister. And I had actually emailed her and I was like, I heard you guys are looking for receptionists at your marketing agency. And she wrote me back and she was like, you don't want that job, but here's another one that like actually would be great, you know? So yeah, I was just doing anything I could to honestly get my foot in the door. I just wanted to be around it, I think, at that point.
I mean, that's passion, and passion does drive ultimately results. Speaking of talent PR, you once said about your early days, there was a feeling like you couldn't win. You're operating from a place of fear. You're not able to be your best self. Obviously, we know those jobs can be really challenging, but I'm just curious, how did you coach yourself past that? Because I think that sometimes when people work in an environment where it's really intense and really stressful, people can take it personally, and it's hard to kind of work through that.
Yeah, look, I think there's been a lot of times in my career that I've gotten to a place of scarcity or have operated from a place of fear. You know, when you're in a new situation, I think it's really easy to second guess yourself. I mean, I remember when I went to Goop and I was the first in-house comms person. And, you know, it was a really small company at the time. I'd been in comms for years, but I'd never been the first in-house person at a startup. You know, I remember feeling a bit paralyzed and I sort of, to be totally honest, like faked it.
Okay. I love that. I love that answer. But like, it's one thing to fake it to the people around you, but internally, how did you push yourself to keep on doing that?
It's hard, but I do think like, okay, when you're faking it to everybody else, eventually you start to one, believe it because you realize that you are making the right decisions. Mm-hmm. And then with experience, the fear sort of slips away. So I remember when I first started Goop and I was like, I really believe these are the three things that we can do for the brand. And I couldn't do them right away. You know, there was like a lot of things I had to build up to. But the more decisions you make, the more you realize like, you know what's right in your gut. Like if you've been honing it, you've been listening, you've been paying attention, you'll get there. But I think it does come with like a good few months or maybe even longer of just acknowledging the uncomfortability of it. You know, like, you know, that feeling when you're like, oh my God, I feel like really, really uncomfortable in the situation. I just want to get out. Acknowledging that feeling, not pushing it away, saying, I know this is here, but I'm going to move through it.
I love that.
Yeah. That's the best advice. It was actually about shame that I think someone said that. I want to say it was Brene Brown, but she was like, you know, when shame is sort of locked in a petri dish, it's going to get bigger and bigger. But if it's open and you're putting it out in the air, eventually it's going to die because you're acknowledging it. You're not ashamed of your own shame, you know?
Yeah. Oh my God. That's great advice. So you did join Goop in 2016.
Yeah.
And as you said, there wasn't like an infrastructure there where there was no real team, essentially. There was no in-house communications. There was no legal team. There was no HR. You also have said that Gwyneth was especially supportive of your growth at that company. How is she as a manager? What would you say you've learned from her management style?
Yeah, I mean, look, there was an incredible team when I got there. It was just that we didn't have like the sort of infrastructure of a big company, like
sure,
legal, HR, all of those things. They were all outsourced, right? And it's very different when you have that in-house and someone who's dedicated full-time versus someone who you're kind of going to at need. But I think she really just put a lot of faith in us. Even when things were really tough, when you have a business, even if it's that small, but you have a high-profile founder or a CEO, you're not really allowed to fail privately. And if for anyone who's been at a startup, there's a lot of failure that happens, right? There's a lot of learning. That's natural. But it's tough when you're doing it on a public stage, I think, for everybody. But she really, I think she just believed in all of us. And she was like, I trust you guys. You're the experts here. Like, you forged this path forward with me. And she's so incredibly involved, which is amazing. But I think she also, like, she is really who I credit for learning how to trust my gut.
That's wonderful. And, you know, I wish we could say that, like, we hear of that more often, but it's even more incredible because people would maybe assume that there's like an ego involved, which even though maybe she doesn't have the experience, a lot of people who don't have the experience still think they know how to do something. So I think it's always so incredible when a manager or a head of a company really acknowledges that the people around them know more about a particular subject than they do and actually lets them do what they do.
Yeah. I mean, look, I've learned that too. And you want to hire people who are experts in their subject, right? And who can explain it to you if there's something you don't understand and who are incredibly smart and talented and like hopefully even smarter than you are. You know, I think that's like really the way that you build a successful company. If you hold it so tightly that you're not letting people do their best work, nothing's going to happen. The company's not going to succeed.
I totally agree. Doesn't mean it doesn't happen, though. So Forbes recognized you as one of the 50 most entrepreneurial CMOs in marketing. And by the way, I have to say, I love the title of this because I think being an entrepreneurial CMO is probably the coolest thing you can be credited for. And it's true. Over the past years that you've been there, you have pushed Goop beyond its boundaries, right? You've taken something that was a newsletter, then a .com, then a podcast, then brick and mortar, pop-ups, events, a Netflix docuseries. So when you think about your role as EVP of brand, how do you really see the job function today? Because it is not one note anymore. It used to be that it would be okay to just have it be a .com and a newsletter, call it a day. But you're thinking so much bigger.
You have to really think about every customer touch point, right? Like every interaction that somebody has with your brand, what are they getting from it? What are they taking away? And with a brand like Goop, which is so visceral, right? Like we've done so much and there's a lot of opinions out there about it. But at the end of the day, we've truly moved culture forward. And we've done that through inspiring content and products. And our hope, and this is what we hear from people every day, is that the brand has actually changed people's lives. So it's really easy, I think, to be laser focused on that. But it's also, we have to be incredibly protective of the brand, right? In every aspect. And it takes a lot of time and care. And it used to be, I mean, you know, that like you would do a Vogue story and a New York Times story and it would reverberate. And it was a very clean media landscape, right? And now it's like, you have to think about how is this going to play out on TikTok? And how is this going to end up on Instagram? And how's that content going to work with each other? And what format is it going to take? And if you're really trying to push a story or a message out in the world, it has to take 19 different iterations almost at this point, right? While all tied back to that central message. So it is a lot more complicated. I mean, I think it's a lot more fun, honestly, in a lot of ways. There's obviously frustrations, but it's exciting to see how content plays out in all of these different ways. And to like really reach people, you know? I remember I was reading something, I think it was about the Obamacare when they were trying to push that out. And they were like, we would do all these briefings for the White House media room and all these things. But the thing that actually moved the needle was we put Obama on Between Two Ferns. And so I think it's really important to think about not just the message, but like who's the messenger.
For sure. My book, obviously called On Brand. When you think about what's on brand for Goop, I mean, I'm sure as much as you all are ideating what you're going to do next. I'm sure you're being pitched all the time for different partnerships and things. How do you decide what feels right and on brand for Goop?
Look, I think at this point, I've been here for 7 years, and I feel like it is like a lot of a gut instinct, you know? But our goal, again, is really to help women optimize their lives. So if we're being pitched, you know, a partnership or an awareness campaign or whatever it is, it always has to ladder up to that. Of like, does this feel like something only we can do? Number one. And then number two, is this really going back to that mission? Are we allowing women to optimize their lives through content or products?
I love what you said. Does this feel like something only we can do? I think that is the best filter, because that is how you really continue to separate the brand from like other brands. I mean, plenty of brands have websites, newsletters, pop-ups, events. So I definitely think that that brand filter is a differentiator. And I know, you know, one of the mission, or maybe the main mission of Goop, is to push unconventional conversations into the mainstream. And clearly, whenever you do something provocative like that, there's going to be some backlash. Do you see that as a success because you're making the conversation happen no matter what?
Look, I think that we are really careful about only doing something that's provocative when there's a true message behind it. So, for example, we did a collaboration with the ACLU last year called the Hands Off My Vagina. And it was taking the candle that, you know, a lot of people have sort of has had all this uproar around it and really rooting it in something real. I think sometimes people will think, oh, Goop is the company that does X, Y, and Z, but they're not actually looking at the why behind it. Sometimes it's frustrating in this kind of media landscape that's really headline driven and that's not reported the way that things used to be. But that's also the nature of where we are right now. And I think, again, like we're really laser focused on what we're trying to build. And we know that this content actually changes lives. We did a campaign last year with Baby to Baby, and it was about this like fake diaper. I don't know if you saw it.
Of course I saw it. It was brilliant.
Well, it like caused a lot of uproar the first day. And then of course, like when the reveal happened, everyone was like, oh my God, it's about the diaper tax, et cetera. And we were really proud of that, because after that campaign, and you know, we can't take credit for it, but I would hope that we had a small part, 7 states repealed the diaper tax. And people talk to me about that campaign all the time.
That's huge.
I think, yes, we have to be in the line of fire, but it's for the betterment of everyone, you know?
I think going back to what you said, the sort of intent behind the activation and the message and like the why of what you're doing is the reason why actually you could probably withstand any amount of backlash, because you know you're doing it for the right reason.
Yeah. Our customers see that. People on the outside, they understand that there is a real purpose to everything that we do and everything that we talk about.
You have had incredible campaigns. I mean, I think also, in a world that's so incredibly noisy, being able to do anything, and I guess, you know, some people might be like, oh, well, Gwyneth's the founder, so of course they're going to get pressed. But like, actually, I think even if you removed Gwyneth, so much of what you do stands on its own. Like that diaper campaign was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, look, I think our goal is to build a real, true brand. Like she's never wanted to build a celebrity brand. You know, she's wanted to build a heritage brand.
Well, you are doing that. You already built it. Now you're just like expanding it. Obviously, you've had incredible experience in your career. This is Leave Your Mark, Freshly Brewed Career Advice. When you think about the types of people you want to hire, what do you look for?
I mean, we're at a startup, right? Like, I think people always think, oh, Goop is this crazy, huge, big company, but like, we're still pretty scrappy. We're still like really focused on growth. So I look for people who, one, are super curious, who are not going to be afraid to ask a lot of questions. I look for people who aren't going to be afraid to look dumb. You know, I think that's one of the biggest lessons that I've learned is ask the dumb question. 9 out of 10 times, somebody else in the room also wants to know the answer to it.
That's true.
And even if they're not, like, you're only helping yourself, you know, like we're all in the earth school. Like if you don't understand something and that's critical to your success at the business or in the meeting or whatever, like ask the question, it's fine. I mean, there's times when you might want to be a little careful about, you know, I wouldn't ask the question in front of like a room full of board members, you know, but you can pull someone aside and ask the questions. I always look for that. I look for somebody who isn't going to be like, oh, I don't understand this, so I'm just going to shy away from it. And I would say that's one of the best advice that I was ever given that I didn't take for a long time, but it's to learn all the things that you're not interested in.
Oh,
I mean, it's honestly so helpful. Like if you're at a startup and you're going to say, I want to do X, Y, and Z, right? I want to do this big, I want to turn on IG shopping. I work on social media. That's my job. And I just want to turn on IG shopping because a lot of people are clicking to buy. You then need to understand, like, what is the tech lift going to be? What is the product lift going to be? What is the strain on cross-functional resources? How much revenue are you going to make versus how much time it's going to take the company? And what does that whole landscape look like? And if you don't understand how those different aspects work, then you're not going to be able to make a recommendation to the business, right? And for a long time, I mean, I was working in magazines. Like, I didn't really care how engineering worked, you know? And I had to learn it because it really was crucial to my success.
That's such a great example. And the answer to that is a lot of back work.
Yeah.
I know firsthand too. Oh my God. Something else you've said in another interview, cultivate strong relationships, over prepare for every meeting, and then go with the flow. I love the go with the flow part. Why do you think going with the flow is an important part of how people show up?
Because I think if you're going with the flow, then you're actually listening. And you're listening to the cues in the room. You're listening to what the other people are saying. Look, you should always be prepared, right? Like I would always say, write down a couple questions that you're going to have beforehand. Know the points you want to hit. But if you are so laser focused on your own agenda, then you're not going to be open to what's actually happening in the room.
Great advice. Because a lot of people, you know, especially in our industry, is like, if something changes, which by the way, it always will, people are like, but we decided X and now we're doing Y. It's like, okay, well, yeah, because now we're doing Y. Like some people can't deal with a massive shift in strategy. And I think being nimble and going with the flow is a superpower, actually.
I agree with you.
One of the other things that you've said is volunteer to do things that may be out of your job description, but need to be done. I don't feel like a lot of people share that mentality anymore. I don't know. I almost feel like people have their job descriptions like on a post-it on their computer. And if people are asked to do something that's beyond the scope, they're like, oh, wait, let me check my list. Oh, nope, that's actually not part of my job. And especially working at a startup, obviously, yeah, that is not going to fly. But what is your opinion in general about the idea of sort of going beyond your job description?
I think if you actually want to succeed, you need to be useful. And that doesn't mean that like you should be overstepping and saying, I'm going to do this part of my job that somebody else is supposed to own, right? Like that's not the goal. But there's always more to be done. And if there's something that nobody is doing that like desperately needs help, you know, like that's where you're really actually going to make a difference. I mean, this is such a funny example, but do you remember that Anne Hathaway movie with Robert De Niro?
Yes, The Intern.
Yes, The Intern. There's one moment where he cleans up the desk that she has that's been like plaguing her the whole time. It's like that would take, what, 15 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
Look for those small things where you're like, oh, I could actually really help here, especially when you're starting out, right? That's the moment where you maybe don't have visibility with all of the execs yet. You need to stand out in a way. And that doesn't mean be overeager, but just try to be useful and helpful. You know, there's times people will come to me, they're like, I have a really great idea for brand marketing. And I love hearing that because my job is to sit there and think of ideas all day long. You know, sometimes you're like, what's left in my brain? Like it's 5 p.m. I have to think of 6 more things to do. And you know, there's plenty of times people have come and been like, I would love to do this, or should we try this? Or can we work with this person? And it's so helpful. Like it's incredible to have people, you know, kind of feel like they're on your team too, right? Like they're kind of your lookout. They're like coming back to you with different ideas. And I think that's great.
I agree. And it's also refreshing because most people don't do it all the time, but also it shows that they're invested in the company, right? They're invested in the success of the company, which I think is great. I mean, everything you said really to me ladders up to this is how you shine at a company. Mm-hmm. When you do take a minute to do those little things that maybe aren't being done. So We're in a crazy time right now. There's tons of layoffs. Obviously, there's economic uncertainty. What would you say to people who feel sort of lost in their next steps in their career?
Well, I would say that it's natural. Gosh, there's so many times when I felt like, what's next and what am I doing and where am I? I'd also say that it passes. I also think that it's not going to feel like this, but having that time to actually figure out what you really want to do is a gift. And it's hard to acknowledge that because I think it's also really stressful. And, you know, when we talked about like being in that place of fear, like it's hard to enjoy anything when you're scared. You know, looking back, there's a lot of things I think I would have loved to try and do. And I was so focused on, I have to be here by this time and I have to be here by this time, that like, I didn't really let myself go off the path that much, you know?
Yeah. I'm the same way. But do you think that goes back a little bit to the way you were raised, in the sense of the lawyer, teacher, doctor conversation of like not really assuming that this whole thing can be a legitimate career that's sustainable?
I was talking to someone the other day, a very close friend, who kind of brought up the same thing, where she was like, are you still like just trying to prove to your parents that you have a real job? And I was like, I think so.
Yes, totally.
And they're so supportive. They're the best.
I get it. They don't mean it. So my dad was from Europe, from Poland, and all four of my grandparents survived the Holocaust. So it was very lawyer, teacher, doctor in my household too. And I gave into it. I was like, I'm going to be pre-med in college. I'm going to be a plastic surgeon. And then junior year, I was like, I want to work in a fashion magazine. And they were like, what? Like, are you kidding? Yeah. So I do think there is a little bit of that in us. And I don't think they meant anything bad by it either, but it's a mentality of like what success means.
Absolutely. And like I said, I understand where that mentality came from with both of our families, right? Like,
yeah.
My mom used to always say when I was younger that this whole idea of finding yourself was a luxury. And it's so funny because, I mean, I look at it so differently, right? With my own daughter, where I'm like, oh, I like want her to go try everything. Like, I want her to really find her passions and cultivate those. But you're right, it is a luxury. You know, we have to be in a situation where we can afford to do that.
How old is your daughter?
She's almost two.
Oh, so yeah, cute. So
she's like still eating chalk. We have a while.
Yeah, she hasn't found her passions yet. But maybe chalk is her passion. Who knows?
Yes, maybe not career passions yet.
Totally. What would you say has been the most unpredictable turn of your career? That you look back and you're like, I didn't see that coming, but wow.
Honestly, I think it was joining Goop, because when I joined, it was really a newsletter, and we had contextual commerce. We had multi-brand products on the site, and we had just started creating our own products. So when I joined, we'd just come out with our beauty line, and the company really shifted, right? It shifted from like a content driven company. It's still at the core of everything we do, but it really shifted to an e-com company. And before I knew it, I found myself working in e-commerce. You know, that's where I was saying the point about like really understanding, like, what does product do and what does engineering do? Like, I had to learn that, I think, a little bit later, right? Because I had come thinking, oh, this is a media model. We have advertising. It was something that's very familiar coming from magazines. And then I think the thing that was amazing about it was our CEO was smart enough to realize that we needed to make a shift, because she was understanding the landscape and the writing on the wall, and was like, look, this isn't sustainable to be solely backed by advertisers anymore. Like, every magazine is folding right now, you know? And so she was really early on creating this sort of new world of contextual commerce and of starting D2C brand before it was like, I mean, this was like ages before every single brand was D2C. You know, you remember that moment where you're like, oh, I'm the Warby of pencils. You were like, what? But I think that was like a big, it was a welcome change, but it was a big surprising change.
What's also, I think, really admirable about that point in your career is that you were learning on the job. Like, a lot of people would maybe want to hide that, maybe feel like they had to say that they had that experience somewhere else, but it was okay for you to be like, okay, I'm going to learn this now because now we're moving into this new direction, which I think is another sort of feather in the cap of Gwyneth to make an environment that you feel safe to do that, because that is not a given.
No, absolutely. And I'm so grateful that we were given that allowance, you know, and given that curiosity. Like, she really did create an environment where it was okay to ask questions and to not know everything.
One of the other learnings you've had there is to not be apologetic. And so many women are apologetic. What advice do you have for women who literally start an email with, sorry, but?
Well, look, I'm still learning.
Fair.
But I don't know. I do think, like, it's so interesting. There's a journalist, Julia Borstein, who I'm not sure if you know her, but she wrote this incredible book called When Women Lead. And I was listening to a talk that she did the other day. And she mentioned something about how we all know that like only 2% of VC money goes to women, right? But apparently when women have a mission-driven component of their business, then people are much more likely to give them money because it fits into the box of like how we think women should be and that they should be nurturing. They should be apologetic sometimes. They should really be like these like soft, empathetic people. And it's not that you can't be that and be an incredible leader, but I thought that was fascinating. And, you know, her point is we can't change things overnight. So like learn the archetypes and learn how to make them work for you, which I thought was really interesting as well. But on the exact apologetic side, it's just like own what you're doing. You don't have to be sorry that you didn't respond to somebody within one day. Like you're busy, you know, it's really important to listen. And when you do make a mistake, yes, you should apologize. But I don't think that should be our normal lexicon of the way that we communicate with each other.
Yeah, I think that's well said. Okay. So just because, you know, Gwyneth, let's use sliding doors. If you had a totally sliding doors moment and you went into a total different career right now, what would it be?
I've actually always wanted to have a boutique.
Ooh, what did you want to sell?
Beautiful vintage homeware items and like totally impractical jewelry. Like retail's a really tough business and I know that. So this is a fantasy land, but yeah.
Never say never. I mean, you have incredible style and an eye for interior. I obviously see your Instagram. So I think that this could happen one day.
Perfect. Everyone come find me in 20 years when I'm like an eccentric lady just with all my cats and in my beautiful store.
Amazing. Maybe when your daughter is old and on her way.
Perfect.
Last question, always the same. How do you ultimately want to leave your mark?
Such a good question. I really love the idea of being able to be successful in your career without compromising your ethics or your integrity. And I think that the more senior you get, the harder that landscape is. But, you know, there's like that old cliche, like work hard and be nice to people. Mm-hmm. Like I really do think you get farther in your career by being nice and by being empathetic and by displaying a lot of those leadership qualities that are inherently feminine. So I think my mark would be that, you know, I would love to make real cultural shifts in the world, but like create incredible friendships and relationships along the way.
I love that. And I agree with you, by the way. I have always believed that being nice takes you further than being, well, I guess the way we have seen many people in the industry over the years. Nora, this was great. Thank you so much for coming on the show. So amazing to dig into your entire journey and can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you. So lovely talking to you.
Thanks so much for listening to Leave Your Mark, the podcast. If you want more career advice, be sure to pick up a copy of my best-selling book, Leave Your Mark. If you're on Instagram, make sure to follow at Leave Your Mark Podcast to stay up with the latest episodes. And of course, say hi to me at Aliza Licht XO. If you're on Twitter, definitely reach out at Aliza Licht. I would love to hear from you. If you want to subscribe to my newsletter or attend a future virtual mentoring event, go to alizalicht.com for more information. And just remember this, if change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.